You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, at least that's what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and this week I welcome former WWE referee Jimmy Corderas to the program. Jimmy is the author of the new book, The Three Count, My Life in Stripes as a WWE Referee. This book is a humorous, dramatic, and sometimes emotional account of Jimmy's 20-plus years as a referee for the world's biggest sports entertainment company. Jimmy Corderas, welcome to OWW Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
First of all, how have you been?
Can't complain. I mean, I'm doing really well, actually.
Good. Well, congratulations on your recent publication, The Three Count, My Life in Stripes as a WWE Referee. Why was now the right time to tell your story?
I just figured that, after some prodding and poking from my wife and my friend Art O'Cal, who we worked together with on Aftermath and before that, right after wrestling, they were the ones who kind of like kept pushing for me to do this, and I was kind of hesitant at first, to be honest, and thinking, you know, who would want to read a bunch of stories of stuff that that would be considered, in my opinion, fun, you know, like just some good stories about a guy who had really enjoyed his time at the WWE, because most of the books that I've read, not all, I don't want to say they're all like that, but a lot of books come out and I, you know, whatever it is, a negative experience that they had there or something like that, and people have an axe to grind, and I didn't have one, so I didn't think that people would be interested, but I guess, there was enough people interested because the good people at ECW Press seemed to think that there would be an interest for it, and apparently, I guess there is.
Well, it's a very, very enjoyable book, and I want to go back, though, to the beginning. You grew up in Toronto. Please explain how that shaped you into the wrestling fan that you became.
Well, the biggest thing about growing up in Toronto when I was younger was, and I explained it in the book, is we had so many different promotions, you know, at the time when, before WWE got off the ground, or WWF at the time got off the ground as a national promotion, and now international. It was pretty much the territory days, but we had pretty much the three main territory promotions we had on television here, which was WWF, NWA, and AWA, all on different channels. And mix that in with a bunch of regional promotions. We used to get Calgary Stampede Wrestling on one of the local channels, and we used to get All-Star Wrestling from Vancouver. We used to get, International Wrestling from Montreal. At one point, we got George Cannon's Detroit promotion and Atlantic Grand Prix Wrestling from the East Coast of Canada. So it was like a smorgasbord of wrestling here. And from the first time I began watching it as a kid, I just fell in love with it. I thought it was, hockey always first here in Canada, but, wrestling quickly almost surpassed that. I don't want to say it did surpass hockey, but I would put it on an equal par with hockey here.
Who were some of your favorite stars growing up? Some wrestlers that really grabbed you?
When I was a kid, there were wrestlers here in Ontario that really, really, captured my attention. Guys like the Mighty Igor, for example. He never spoke, apparently. He was the Polish strongman, never spoke English, but, very friendly, cool little baby face that really, I think, appealed to kids a lot more than adults. And there was another wrestler by the name of Tex McKenzie, and when you talk about the heels, there was a heel tag team here in Canada called the Love Brothers, Hartford and Reginald Love. They were almost like a hippie tag team wearing tie-dye tights, very similar to what you see Fandango wearing today, that kind of sort of pants. And it was more the colorful characters that I really got to enjoy. And then being from Ontario here, of course, there were the Tolis brothers, and being of Greek descent, of course, kind of enjoyed them as well.
So you got your exposure to pro wrestling initially on television, but I enjoyed your story about seeing your first live wrestling show, which was a special Maple Leaf wrestling event. Why did seeing pro wrestling live have such an impact on you?
It was just surreal to be in the audience and just be a part of the excitement live. I mean, it's like, again, I bring up hockey, of course, being up here in Canada. You know, the first time I went to a Toronto Maple Leafs game, you know, it was different. You don't get the commentary like you do on television, and you don't get the replays, but the atmosphere and the excitement is just, it's just indescribable. You know, when you get, 15, 20,000 people all in one place cheering, screaming, yelling, it's just infectious.
Mm-hmm. I actually have to ask you, by the way, to stop talking about hockey. I'm a Pittsburgh Penguins fan, and I'm smarting right now, down 3-0.
Oh, geez. Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, I feel your pain. We lost to the Bruins as well, so.
Yeah. Now, you started going to a lot of garden shows. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, you started taking a lot of pictures and selling these pictures, and you actually got caught doing it, which turned out to be a good thing.
Yeah, well, what I didn't realize at the time was it was I guess somewhat illegal to be selling with copyrighted material, I guess. So the Ilio Zarlengo, who worked for Jack Tunney and used to take the pictures for him up here, he caught me selling them outside the gardens. And mm-hmm. instead of turning me in, basically he was real nice, and we actually became friends, and he introduced me to Jack, and that's how I got my break. So funny how something that's technically illegal got me my start in wrestling.
I knew Jack Tunney simply as, of course, the WWF president from television. That was just for TV purposes. What was his real role in professional wrestling, though?
Before getting hooked up with the WWF at the time, he was the main promoter here in Canada. And he would book talent for Maple Leaf Wrestling from not just one promotion. He would get, before Vince McMahon Jr. went national, you know, they would get talent from the WWF, they would get talent from AWA, but their main source of talent was Crockett Promotions, mm-hmm. Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling talent, and he was the main promoter here in Canada, and when Vince bought the territory from him, he was basically the promoter for WWF up here in Canada, and as you said, figurehead president.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great quote in your book. Jack Tunney gave you your first job, and you were told, quote-unquote, you're going to see a lot of things that will go on in this business, whether in the locker room, on the bus, in the hotel, or anywhere else, unquote. He didn't want to know about any of this, and, you know, only in pro wrestling, right? I mean, you wouldn't hear that as a first line of work when you go to an accounting firm.
Yeah, very true, and I think it was done, you know, in hindsight. You know, they always say hindsight is 20/20. In hindsight, I think he said that to me more to protect me, because he understands that there's that code that you don't, you know, mm-hmm. you don't rat, you don't stooge out the boys, and I think he was just preparing me for, you know, another lesson in the unwritten rules of professional wrestling.
I think it was an indication of how the business has changed, though, in a sense, because isn't it remarkable today? Wrestlers have virtually no privacy anymore because of social media, camera phones. I mean, the public has this demand to, like, be in on every story, and I just imagine that pressure can be really tough for the talent today.
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, because of the advent of the internet and social media and all that sort of stuff, it's almost next. Everybody's got a cell phone camera.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you go, when you're out in public, potentially somebody's going to take your picture or put you on film or get a video of you, doing whatever it is. And sometimes it could be something innocent, but, you know, it all it takes is the right phrasing and a snap of the camera at the right time, and they could turn it into something, you know, far greater than it actually is.
Right, right. Well, your first job was to drive WWF talent to and from the shows. One of the highlights of the book for me, Jimmy, was a lot of the road stories that you told, the joys and the hardships of life on the road. There's so many to choose from. Could you share maybe one or two of your favorites?
Yeah, like the one I told in the book, you know, getting the advice from now Hall of Famer Bruno Sammartino. When
mm-hmm.
I mean, here's this you know, early 20s young guy, you know, getting to be in a minibus driving guys like Bruno Sammartino and Lou Albano and Freddie Blassie and all these, you know, legends of the business. And all of a sudden, you know, I always kept quiet. You know what I mean? It was like, keep my mouth shut, but listen to the stories, because it was so cool to listen to them, you know, just chat back and forth and, you know, reminisce themselves about certain guys. But when Bruno Sammartino actually spoke to me and asked me for my, you know, how long have I been in the business, and offering me his advice, and I thought it was kind of funny, but at the same time scary. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Bruno's telling you, well, take some advice, get out before it gets in your blood. I'm like, wow, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I guess he was on the mark there, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was dead right. You know, once it gets in your blood, it never leaves. I mean, even to this day, you know, 4 years removed from the WWE, you know, I do miss it, but at the same time, you know, I have moved on. So, you know, but,
that's good.
You know, I watch pretty much all the wrestling I can when I'm, you know, when I have the opportunity, so.
Well, one of the other road stories I loved, you were driving to Hershey near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the little town called Intercourse, Pennsylvania. I'm from York, Pennsylvania, originally. We used to go to Hershey all the time, and so when you told the story about that sign, we've all seen it where I grew up, and that made me laugh out loud.
Well, you know, especially coming from Canada where, you know, we're presumed to be a little more, you know, reserved, so to speak. You know, and then you're driving for the first time and seeing that sign in Intercourse, Pennsylvania, you know, I had to laugh. What can I
yeah.
say? And, you know, and I guess, I don't know if Jack appreciated my humor, but, you know, hey.
Well, eventually you became a member of the ring crew. For those that don't know, what are the responsibilities of the ring crew?
You know, there's several parts of being in the ring crew, depending on, you know, if you're the, at the time when I first started, you know, everybody had, there were several ring crews, so to speak. Like, for example, Tony Chimmel and Mike Chioda mm-hmm. had their own ring, and they were a ring crew based out of New Jersey. Eventually, Jack Doan and Chad Patton out of the Midwest, out of, like, near the Chicago area and the Illinois area, and so on and so forth. I was the guy up here in Canada that would do, you know, pretty much Ontario, Quebec, even out to the East Coast at times, where we had a ring there, and, you know, upstate New York and Michigan and that sort of stuff. Basically, the job is, you know, you have a truck with a ring in it, and you drive to the shows, and you're responsible for setting it up and making sure that everything is safe and good to go, and if anything needs repair, it's up to you to fix whatever needs to be fixed, and just be on call, even at times when you're also refereeing. You got to be kind of on call to fix or repair anything that may go wrong. Hopefully
mm-hmm.
it doesn't, of course. You know, you're always hoping that nothing goes wrong. But, you know, and then after the show is over, you tear everything down, put it back in a truck, and you're off to the next town. Yeah, starts all over again the next day.
Yeah, and I loved how you said in the book, once the ring would be set up, you started kind of, you know, wrestling some matches, learning how to take bumps with your fellow referees. Was there ever a part for you, Jimmy, that you thought maybe you wanted to actually be one of the wrestlers?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody who gets into this business at one point or another, you know, has maybe at least in the back of their mind a little bit of a dream of becoming a, you know, a professional wrestler, a superstar, a big, you know, wrestling personality. And of course, it hit me too, but once I began refereeing, I realized that, you know what, I think I found my calling. I really
mm-hmm.
I really fell in love with refereeing, and one of the things that struck me was, I wish I could remember who actually gave me this advice. He said, you know, do you like refereeing? And I said, yes, I do. And they said, well, enjoy it, because there's more longevity in refereeing than there is in actually wrestling. unless you're a Ric Flair or somebody like that. I mean, there are exceptions to the rule, but
right.
You know, and he says, well, you can have a longer career refereeing and still be a part of the business, which is great.
I give you a lot of credit, because as you outline in the book, when Pat Patterson suggested to Jack Tunney that you'd be a good person to perhaps train to become a referee, your success did not happen overnight. You went out, you got your referee's outfit, but you didn't start working matches right away. How hard was the waiting game until you actually got into the main rotation of referees?
It was nerve-wracking because, there's some people take different approaches. Like, some people would be, I don't want to say pests, but they would constantly be, okay, so when am I getting my chance? When am I getting my chance? When am I getting my chance? You know, that kind of that, are we there yet kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not like that. I was never like that. I was kind of like, okay, I'll occasionally ask, but I never really pushed it. I figured when they were ready to show me the ropes, they were going to show me the ropes. You know, they told me to go out and get the stuff, so I figured, you know, it'll happen eventually. And it was just like, okay, but when? And I kept waiting for it, and then it just kind of like happened out of the blue after a little while.
There's a great story in the book. I don't want to give it away. I want people to read the book about the first time you did referee a national match for World Wrestling Federation, and it's with great humor you tell the story. So people should definitely enjoy that part of the book.
Yeah, like I said, talk about being thrust to the wolves, out of the frying pan into the fire right out of the gate.
Well, and then you started gaining more and more experience, more confidence in the ring, working TV matches, even taking a bump or two. And I can't believe your first big bump, you took the one-man gang's finisher. I mean, talk about trial by fire.
Yeah, absolutely. What a shocker. And you know, and it was at a time where I didn't want to say, hey, look, I've never taken this bump before. You're going to take this bump. Okay, sure, no problem, whatever you need. And then, but in the inside you're going, oh boy, I hope this turns out okay.
When I started reading your book, I was hoping that you would talk about what a referee actually does during a match. And so I really enjoyed the aspects of the book where you describe your roles and responsibilities and how you have to learn that and how you have to be taught that. And you're always learning, you're always learning. I think people would be surprised to read how much you actually communicate with the wrestlers during the match.
Yeah, it really is a three-way dance or a five-way dance, depending on how many participants in the ring. I stress a lot that good referees continue to learn. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you never stop learning. And not only as a referee, but even as a performer, as a wrestler, you should never stop learning because, you know, the business is constantly changing, the fans are constantly changing, and the way that the product is presented is always changing as well. So the role of the referee, even though basically doesn't change, you're technically the authority figure, it's all the little things that go on in the ring, like you said, like communicating with the talent and trying to pass messages back and forth and trying to, you know, discreetly do that without mm-hmm. overtly looking like you're actually, you know, hey, this is what so-and-so said. You know what I mean? I honestly believe it's an art form in doing it discreetly without looking like you're actually, you know, doing what you're actually doing. So it's I don't want to say it's the hardest thing in the world, but it's not as easy as people think.
Mm-hmm. Well, how hard was it for you to learn things like proper ring positioning so that you're not covering the action that, you know, the television has to see, but also the people in the audience?
Yeah, see, that's the fine line you gotta. See, I always put it this way. The referee is kind of like a supporting player, a supporting actor. He's not to be overtly visible unless, you know, the situation calls for it, if it's, mm-hmm. you know, involves a spot where that involves the referee or something like that. Other than that, you're kind of like there to enhance the match and help progress the story being told in the match. And by doing that, it took me a long time to kind of figure it out that, hey, you know, like in certain situations, for example, like if someone's in a rear chin lock, if I'm, you know, checking to see if it's a choke or you know, asking if they want to give up or that sort of thing, like, you know, doing the job that a professional wrestling referee would do, I wouldn't do it, you know, doing it right in front of him so that people can't see his face, because he needs to sell so that people could see him tell his story.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of got to do it from the side, so to speak, so that people could see him, but also at the same time not be too far away where people don't think you're doing your job at the same time. So it's kind of like a fine line, and it takes a lot of, I guess, trial and error to figure out exact positioning, but You know, it's like I said, it's an ongoing process. It's always learning.
You also said something in the book about how when you're a member of the ring crew, all your travel expenses are paid for. But as a referee, kind of like if you're one of the workers on the roster, you have to pay for your own travel expenses, which is why a lot of you carpool and share hotel rooms. I thought that was really, really shocking.
Yeah, I guess that's just the way it's done because, you know, referees are, you know, fall under the category, you know, of talent, as in, you know, under the talent relations department.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're if you're just a referee, then you're considered talent. So that's how it works for the talent, and that's why they, you know, like you said, they carpool and they share rooms to save on expenses, and that's the way it was with referees. Fortunately, I got to travel a lot with my old travel partner, Tony Chimmel, so that helped cut expenses down quite a bit.
Well, you write a lot about your friendship with Tony. What makes your relationship so special, even today?
It's, you know, we're kind of cut from the same mold, you know what I mean? We mm-hmm. we both have the same kind of quirky sense of humor, you know, a lot of likes and dislikes that are similar, but at the same time, you know, we didn't take ourselves seriously. We never did. And we always had fun with what we were doing. I mean, like I tell people, you know, we had our routine where our, you know, we do the show, we tear down the ring, and we jump in the truck or the car, whatever the case may be. And first thing we do is we talk about the show that night, what we liked, what we didn't like. We'd break it down. We'd talk about the business. We'd solve all the all the troubles that were wrong with professional wrestling, and in our own little way. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And you know, we'd have little conversations, and after that, it was, you know, okay, enough wrestling. Let's go on to talk about whatever it was, whether it was the song on the radio or where we're going to eat, or you know what I mean. It was, but we got along and we had fun, and you know, they used to call us actually Hornswoggle coined the phrase. They called us Waldorf and Stadler.
Yeah, from the Muppets, right.
Yeah,
that's funny. When you were assigned to the main event in the inaugural Survivor Series in 1987, is that the moment when you thought, you know, man, I've really made it?
Yeah, you know what? I wasn't thinking that. That wasn't like the thought that came into my mind.
Hmm.
At the time, it was more like, I can't believe I'm here, and I can't believe I'm assigned to a match involving 10 of the biggest superstars in pro wrestling, like Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, you know, Paul Orndorff, Bam Bam Bigelow, all these guys are in the ring, and I'm like, holy crap, I can't believe I'm here.
That's interesting. I still remember watching that pay-per-view. You know, that was right when I was becoming a big, big pro wrestling fan, so I enjoyed the stories about Survivor Series 1987. You know, you've also mentioned in the book an incident or two where you were kind of in hot water after a match for whatever reason. I don't think people have an idea, Jimmy, that upper management is right there in the gorilla position watching these matches, and the pressure, especially on live TV, is immense, right?
Yeah, and thank goodness, for the most part, those were taped incidents, so they didn't...
Right.
Yeah, they didn't air on live television, but still, yeah, because when you know that, you know, all the bosses, including Vince McMahon, are up in gorilla and they're watching, and you know, Vince is a perfectionist, and he wants, you know, his product displayed the way he likes it, and I, you know, I don't blame him for that. Obviously, you know, he wants things done his way, and if he sees something that he doesn't like, he'll definitely let you know. And sometimes he's a little more animated than other times, but but like I said in the book, for the most part, you know, it's kind of like one of those, you know, he gets a little upset, then 5 minutes later, everything's cool.
Right. And it goes back to, you know, the motto that you present in the book, by always learning and always trying to get better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, we couldn't go through the whole interview without mentioning Vince McMahon. I had the pleasure of meeting him one time in Phoenix for WrestleMania 26. And Jimmy, I couldn't believe he's a mountain of a man. He is just, I was just in shock and awe of how big he is. But I really liked your description of him in the book when you say he's demanding, but he, quote, never dogs it or phones it in ever, unquote. And in the end, isn't that what has made him so successful?
I believe it is. I mean, I guess maybe, I don't know if it's to this day, if it's to that extent, but he, you know, he used to, it was 24/7. He used to live, eat, sleep, for lack of a better expression, crap wrestling, his company 24/7. And, you know, he poured everything he had into the WWE and the WWF back in the day. So, and he's also the kind of guy that wouldn't ask people to do anything that he wouldn't do himself. Now, he's getting a little older, and I hate to say it, but he may not be able to do some of the things that he would ask some of the guys to do anymore. But at the time, you know, like, for example, like, you know, do you remember WrestleMania 12 when Shawn Michaels ziplined down from the top of the building in that famous entrance and stuff like that? Earlier in the afternoon, Vince did that. You know what I mean? Picture Vince ziplining down in the afternoon and smiling and having a good time doing it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's, you know, that's the way he is. He works hard, and he just expects everybody else to work hard as well.
I guarantee you that all of my friends, even the ones who have never watched wrestling, know about the two Dave Hebners match. What brilliant booking, and pretty cool that you were there that night in Indianapolis.
Yeah, what was even funnier was, you know, I was in the dark about it like everybody else and kind of stumbled upon the fact that there were two Hebners there that night, which was kind of cool.
I'll never forget it. I have friends who never watch wrestling, and they, you know, you mentioned Dave Hebner, and they still laugh.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Probably Dave and Earl Hebner, probably the most famous refs ever.
And when it seems like, from your experience that you talk about in the book, most of the referees were supportive of each other, almost like a tight-knit little fraternity inside this big world of professional wrestling.
Yeah, we were, because, you know, even amongst the wrestlers themselves, you know, I hate to use this term, you know, they're little cliques. Everybody has their own little group that they like hanging out with, where you gravitate towards certain people and you become buddies. And with the referees, it was a little different because we weren't technically one of the boys, but at the same time, you know, we weren't treated any differently than the boys. But we all got along because, you know, at least for the most part, we had each other's backs. I mean, every once in a while, you know, just like any kind of family type atmosphere, you have arguments and disagreements. But for the most part, you know, we had each other's back, which was really cool.
Well, this book is packed with fun little details. For example, I didn't know you helped Kurt Hennig come up with the name of his finishing move, the Perfect Plex. I had no idea you were the referee for the Pile Driver music video, which I loved. I loved all the WWF CDs back in the day. Of course, Pile Driver, the song by Coco Beware. And you've got to be the only referee that got to slam a steel cage door into Andre the Giant's head.
I don't know if I was the only one, but but yeah, that, wow. Again, really cool. I couldn't believe, I would expect maybe, especially considering that Timmy White was there that night also, refereeing on the card, so I thought maybe that spot would be given to someone like him, but for Andre to have the, you know, enough faith in me to do that.
Sure.
Wow, you know, again, an honor.
Now, you mentioned on page 64 that a problem developed between you and one of your bosses, Terry Garvin, and that led to you kind of being phased out of your normal responsibilities. In general, Jimmy, did you think that was the end of your time as a full-time referee?
I don't want to say that I thought that it was the end of it, but I thought that it was definitely in jeopardy, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I thought maybe it was going to be one of those situations where I was just going to, you know, from that point forward, I would be used more on a part-time basis as opposed to a full-time basis. But, you know, again, I was one of those people who never complained again and just kind of, it took a while. I rode out the storm and eventually things worked out, so.
Well, they did, and you came back as a full-time official. And as you moved along in your WWE career, you even had the opportunity at times to participate in some actual storylines. How nervous were you when you had to kind of step outside your comfort zone and become more of a quote-unquote character?
Yeah, it was a little different because, like I always say, I was very happy being like a background player and not being a focal point, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So especially like in 1999 when they did the scab referee angle where, you know, the guys went on strike and I was the only one who not to go on strike. You know, it was a little bit nerve-wracking because on the Sunday Night Heat program before the pay-per-view where, you know, I got my butt kicked by all the refs, I did a little backstage interview with Lillian Garcia and explaining why I didn't join my brothers on the picket line, and it was like a little nerve-wracking, because standing right there while we're taping the backstage interview is Vince Russo and Vince McMahon, and I'm thinking, oh geez, I hope I don't say anything wrong, I hope I did this right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're just saying, well, just be yourself, and I'm, oh, okay, I can do that,
Without going over the whole Montreal Screwjob incident, which you cover in great detail in the book, did you realize at the time this was going to be perhaps the most infamous moment in wrestling history?
At the time, I knew it was huge, but I didn't know it was going to take a life of its own. I mean, for so many years afterwards, for it not only to be talked about, but to it be mimicked, I guess, so many
yeah.
different times by so many different companies. It took a life of its own. And, you know, everybody has their theories about, I talk about it in the book a little bit, about, who really knew what, and mm-hmm. was it really a screw job, or was this a big elaborate, plan by both Vince and Bret? And honestly, I don't think it was, but there's just a lot of stuff there that makes, that gets the conspiracy theorists talking, and I can see how it could happen, and I can see how you can look at certain details, certain minor details that happened that night and go, you know what, I kind of question what really went on that night, but at the end of the day, I've talked to Bret before about it, and I think what happened that night was genuine, and I felt bad for Bret, but at the same time, he kind of half understood what Vince did.
But it's just remarkable that we still talk about it all these years later.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just it probably will go down as probably one of the most infamous events in wrestling history.
The tribute to the troop shows that you participated in seemed to make a lasting impact on you. Can you put into words what those experiences taught you?
It taught me, I've always had kind of a respect for the troops, and for what they do in putting themselves in harm's way. But being there and being amongst them that respect factor grew multiple times. I mean, those men and women, I have nothing but the utmost respect for what they do, and they were so happy that we were there to perform for them. But they kept thanking us when we kept thanking them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was kind of like a mutual respect kind of thing. They thanked us for coming there to perform for them, but we were thanking them for what they did, and it was one of the coolest. You talk about WrestleMania moments and stuff like that. That's something completely different. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Which stands out even maybe in a little way, even stands out more than a WrestleMania.
Well, it's emotional even for us at home watching. I can imagine what it's like to be there.
Yeah, and they used to joke. They joked the two times that I went over that. Canada didn't send any troops over to Iraq, so they settled for me.
I thought it was pretty cool to read how involved you were at times in helping the road agents and the wrestlers come up with their match finishes. When they used your ideas, that had to feel pretty good.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I said, again, with this learning curve that I always talk about, how never stop learning. One of the things I always did was, you're around people like Pat Patterson, you're around people like Arn Anderson and Fit Finlay and Ricky Steamboat and all these great minds of the business, and you can't help, if you pay attention, you can't help but learn from them. So, they were always receptive to ideas from everybody,
mm-hmm.
which was really, really cool. So when you had an idea, all you had to do was just say, hey, do you mind if I pitch an idea here? And they say, absolutely, go ahead. And, and a few times they'll use it, and sometimes they won't. And
mm-hmm.
and when they do, it makes you just feel really good. And I never did it to try and get myself over or anything like that. I just, wanted to help, you know, and
to help the product.
Exactly. And you know, it's a great feeling when you feel that you did something to help.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you mentioned several times where the wrestlers kind of broke script or things didn't go as planned during one of the matches. I guess as a referee, you can never take anything for granted in the ring, huh?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you know, Arn Anderson is one who always mentions that, you know what, he always hated when you planned out a match from start to finish. In his mind, it should be, you know what, you got the beginning, you got the end, the middle should be all kind of feel out the crowd kind of thing and that sort of thing. But when you got something planned that doesn't go quite according to plan, you know, sometimes, you know, you got to call audibles out there. And as a referee, you got to be on your toes and make sure that you, you're really paying attention to make sure that you don't screw up the audible, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Of all the celebrities you met working for the WWE, who was your favorite?
Oh, wow.
It's an amazing list that you have in the book of celebrities. Maybe it's not even fair to ask who's your favorite.
Yeah, but if I do have to pick one, Michael Clark Duncan was probably one of my favorites because
mm-hmm.
he was such a good guy. I mean, you know, you talk about gentle giants and guy. He was such a really amazingly good guy and fun to be around and always, and he had this infectious smile. And for some reason, you know, he was one of the celebrities that I got to chat with and become friendly with, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't want to single him out as my favorite, but he's definitely near the top of the list for sure.
Looking back at your career, you've been deeply affected by some of the biggest tragedies in pro wrestling history. The passing of Eddie Guerrero, the horrific Owen Hart accident, the awful ending to Chris Benoit's life. These men were friends of yours, and I applaud you for dealing with these events in the book. It shows the depth of affection you all had for each other in the business, and frankly, the book is a more complete narrative because you were open and honest about them, so thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I thought it should be included. As much as I wanted the book to be a fun book, those were three people who throughout my career were not only friends, but also helped me out with my career. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it was offering advice or just, you know, being a friend and that sort of thing. So I felt it needed to be told. The stories needed to be told. And, you know, as far as Owen, I've never really spoken outside of my family to really anybody about, you know, like really what I was going through emotionally
mm-hmm.
through that whole thing. And I thought, you know, maybe this is the right time to kind of let people know how I felt and how I thought everybody was feeling from my vantage point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it might help be a little cathartic, so to speak, and putting it down on paper, you know, it helped to some degree, but didn't, you know, not a whole lot. Yeah,
sure.
It's one of those tough things I'm going to have to live with, I guess.
When WCW was purchased by Vince McMahon, I heard there was a lot of unrest within the locker room. You know, there's just a lot of guys for fewer jobs. How did this affect the referees of both companies?
Well, I think it affected the WCW guys more than us because they were the ones who were wondering whether they were going to be brought on board or not, and they had several referees at the time, and I, if I'm not mistaken, when Vince took over WCW, I think it was Nick Patrick, Charles Robinson, and I believe Billy Silverman,
mm-hmm.
the three that came over. Well, eventually, later on, Scott Armstrong and Mickey Henson came over as well, but those were the three that came over at the time, and I know there was a few guys that may have been a little bit anxious as to whether or not their positions would be secure with the company on the WWE side as well. I didn't feel that way. I thought there was room for everybody. I thought all it meant, the company's growing, so obviously, you know, there's going to be more people, and there's going to be more shows, so they're going to need more people, and I never felt threatened, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I just welcomed the opportunity and actually became good friends with Charles and Nick Patrick as well. So,
good.
Yeah, more brothers added to the locker room.
True. You mentioned that your favorite Royal Rumble moment was the match between Batista and John Cena in 2005. At this time, Jimmy, did you think John Cena would eventually become the face of the WWE?
I thought there was the opportunity was there. I didn't see him taking off the way he did at the time. I mean, it's very tough, especially after an era where you had guys like The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin and
right.
And that, you know, Attitude Era and just after the post-Attitude Era were, you know, two of the arguably the biggest stars ever in the business. And you're thinking, wow, you know, are they going to be able to catch that lightning in a bottle again? And you know what? You got to give John Cena credit because, you know, people dog him for his so-called, quote-unquote, five moves of doom and all that crap that they all say. But nobody works harder than he does, you know. And he really, really, you know, like I said, he works extremely hard to do what he does. And he gives so much outside of just wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Like he gives so much of himself. He's a great representative for the company, if you ask me. And I'm happy that he's where he's at today.
I met John Cena for the first time this past year at WrestleMania 29, and I thought he was just a real nice guy at the Access session. And during the autograph session, I just wanted to mention this for the record, he gave everybody an extra 8x10 signed in addition to the item that they brought. You know, just a, you know, people don't sometimes appreciate that side of him, and it's really a shame.
Yeah, it is, and it's just, he gets a bad rap, and I'm not pointing fingers at any group of people, but it almost seems like it became cool to boo him.
Right.
As opposed to booing him because, for whatever reason. It almost seemed like, hey, these guys over here are booing him. That sounds like fun. Let's do it. And now it just caught on, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Yeah. I think he's very underrated, especially, you know, a lot of people point to a lot of his great, good matches that he's had. Well, he was in the ring with CM Punk. Well, he was in the ring with so-and-so. Well, it takes two. I mean, you know, there's that old adage of being able to wrestle with a broomstick,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, sometimes you need more than just a broomstick.
Well, it goes into what we're discussing here today about really wrestling being with the three of you in there and you being a big part of that. And I wanted to now move into your career at WrestleMania. You should be very proud that you took part in 14 WrestleManias. By the way, starting with WrestleMania 4 in Atlantic City, which was a show I actually happened to attend, it was an amazing moment in your career and an amazing moment in my childhood.
Oh, wow, yeah. So you got to see me knock myself out, basically.
Yeah, I did. I was, like I mentioned, grew up in Pennsylvania, so we went to Atlantic City for WrestleManias 4 and 5. It was just a big, big thrill. Your book does a great job chronicling, though, each WrestleMania you participated in, the matches that you participated in, and what it meant to you. There's just a lot to go through there. The two that I really wanted to mention, though, Jimmy, was WrestleMania 22 in Chicago. You actually gave up your spot on the card to allow a fellow referee, Chris Kay, you know, to actually have a match on the main show. In fact, it happened to be The Undertaker's casket match. That's a real class move.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know what? As a referee as well, you know, obviously wrestlers' goal is to make it to the WWE, and when you do is to participate in WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody wants a WrestleMania moment, and here's a young fellow who's never had that, and I had already been booked to work the Money in the Bank match, I believe. I think that was the other match I was working.
I believe it was, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know what? I had a match on the card, and to do a second match, I thought, you know what? I asked if it would be all right, especially considering he would have been out there with, I believe he was out there with Nick Patrick for the casket match. So, you know, you had the veteran out there to kind of make sure everything runs smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why not? Especially in wrestling, you never know when you're going to have that opportunity again. And to be in a match involving The Undertaker, I mean, wow, you know. So hopefully it was, you know. It was, you know, not that he remembers that I did this for him. Hopefully he just remembers that he, you know, takes that with him, that he got to do a WrestleMania match involving The Undertaker, you know.
Right. I thought that was a real class move.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And of course, the other moment I want to mention, which you call the highlight of your career, refereeing the main event of WrestleMania 24, the world title match between Edge and The Undertaker. Do you ever watch the match on DVD and just shake your head at the enormity of the moment?
I haven't watched it in a little while, but obviously, I'm not going to lie. I have watched it several times. But it's little things that you notice watching it back and that you may have not noticed before, like a little moment or a little reaction or a little something. And every time I watch it, I find more and more, every time I watch it, I kind of pay attention more and more to the crowd. And see how the crowd is reacting, and just how the last, I don't know, I want to say like the last 10 minutes of that match, if you look out into the crowd, nobody's sitting down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, while the match was going on, I'm really not hearing them. It was so surreal that I was so focused on what was going on and wanting to do right by the match. And make sure that the two guys in the ring got to tell their story, that I really don't remember hearing the crowd very much. But then watching it back, seeing the reaction and how, you know, loud they were and how into it they were, it kind of freaks me out a little bit.
That's a mark of a true professional, though, because I imagine it'd be very easy to get overwhelmed by that, by the crowd and the moment you're in.
Yeah, it can happen, and it has happened to me in the past, where you kind of get caught up in the moment, but... especially for that match with Edge and The Undertaker, like I said, I was so focused on like I said, wanting to do right by them that I kind of almost blocked everything else out.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Edge, Adam Copeland, wrote the foreword to your book, and he had some very nice things to say about you. It's obvious that you two have a special friendship. Why do you think Adam was able to realize his dream, you know, get out of that crowd in Toronto at WrestleMania 6, and become a star in this business?
Simple, passion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see it. You could see it when I happened to be in Hamilton when he had his first match, which he wasn't under contract. He was just Carl DeMarco, who is president of WWE in Canada here at the time. I can't remember whether it was Ken Shamrock or somebody like that was supposed to wrestle Bob Holly that night, and due to travel difficulties, couldn't make it in. And Carl had called Adam and said, "Are you available? Come to Hamilton, bring your stuff." So he showed up and he got an opportunity to work with Bob Holly. And just from that first night, you can see that here's this guy that really, really wants it, you know. And he seems like a good guy, and he seemed like to have the right attitude and that sort of stuff. And then to see him evolve and grow over the years and just be a student of the game. And if there's one thing... I could say about Adam is that if there's one guy who's really, you know, guys have certain, I don't want to call them specialties, but, you know, knacks at little things that they're really, really excel at. And one thing that Adam's really excels at is putting matches together that make sense, that tell a great story. And, you know, that's why I'm kind of surprised that he's not kind of taking more of a backstage role with the WWE now.
Mm-hmm. I guess he's had some success acting here. That's going well for him.
Oh, yeah, he's doing pretty good, yeah. And I guess he's got a pretty much a reoccurring role on that, on Haven, which is really good.
And, of course, inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. And I'm sure you know that he was also honored this past year at the Cauliflower Alley Club reunion with a men's wrestling award. That was a very special moment.
Absolutely. I just wish I could have been there. I'm meaning to get out to the Cauliflower Alley Club, but I think I'm definitely going shooting for 214, that's for sure.
Yeah, I sure hope you make it. I myself am actually a CAC board member, and so I highly recommend it to you and to all the listeners. And your friend and broadcast partner, Art Oakle, was the MC for the Tuesday Night Banquet this year at the CAC.
Yeah, I apologize for that. No, I'm kidding. I'm sure he did a bang-up job. He's really, really good at what he does. And
he sure
and
is. It was a big hit.
Yeah, he's really, really helped me actually transform from into my new career in broadcasting, so I really owe him a lot.
Well, I certainly hope you can make it. And again, it was a very, very nice moment for Adam. There was a great chapter in your book about the rules a referee should follow in the ring. We touched a little bit about this. Is this something that maybe you would like to do more aggressively in the future? Maybe pursue, you know, become a full time referee trainer?
I never really thought of doing it full time, but I really enjoy, you know, kind of conducting clinics or classes for that. There's a school up here in Toronto that the guy who runs the school is a friend of mine, and every once in a while I'll drop in and try and help out there a little bit and maybe just pass on a little bit of what I think a professional wrestling referee should be or how they should work, and maybe just offer a little advice. I'd like to give back a little bit, because here's for over 20 years the wrestling business has been great to me, and mm-hmm. Maybe this is a way for me to pay it back a little bit.
Mm-hmm. When you stopped refereeing, you eventually realized that you wanted to get into broadcasting. Explain how you went from refereeing, the action in the ring, to becoming one of the most popular wrestling broadcasters in Canada.
Well, thank you for that. I didn't know I was that popular, but it's funny. I everybody has aspirations of. A lot of people do. I don't want to say everybody, but a lot of people have. You go out and you're watching wrestling or whatever sporting event, and you're thinking, man, I'd love to do play-by-play, or I'd love mm-hmm. to do commentary, or I'd love to do this, and they don't realize that it's not easy. And just like for me, for example, being so close to it with the WWE and seeing guys like Michael Cole and JR and JBL and those guys doing it, those guys are fantastic. And to be able to do something like that is very, very difficult, and obviously you got to learn. So it was something that I was hoping to do more. I don't know if it was a wrestling thing that I wanted to do, but I wanted to get into some form of broadcasting, so I took a course and mentioned Arda. Arda was a big help in getting me started with our podcast, and mm-hmm. which eventually turned into Aftermath, which morphed into a TV show. Mm-hmm. Which is still on the air up here in Canada on the Score Television Network, which is cool. And that too is also a learning process. I'm constantly learning at that too. I'm trying to better myself with every show if I can. But it's really cool. It's a different world. I've gone from being like the background guy to someone people actually listen to, which is kind of different. That's for sure.
Well, before I let you go, fill us in on where we can find you in social media, Twitter, Facebook, or maybe even Aftermath. When is that on the air?
It airs in Canada on the Score Television Network, which, starting in July, will now be rebranded Sportsnet 360. Because the station was purchased by Rogers Sportsnet. It's on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on the Score Television Network here in Canada. We do other stuff as well. During Raw and SmackDown, we do these little segments called Ask the Ref, where people send in questions and I answer them, on the air. And if people want to hit me up on Twitter, it's very simple. It's at Jimmy Corderas, all lowercase, one continuous long word. And I'm also on Facebook under the same name. And I'm more active on Twitter, to be honest, than I am on Facebook, that's for sure. And
mm-hmm.
And if anybody, I try to answer everybody back as best I can.
Very good. Well, I'll make sure to post all of your contact information there when we have the interview hosted here on OWW. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me here on OWW Radio. Congratulations on a great publication, The Three Count, My Life in Stripes as a WWE Referee, and also on a great career, really through many interesting eras of WWE.
Dave, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and thank you for your kind words.
You got it. Best wishes to you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Now, don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, I am David. Thank you again to Jimmy Corderas for today's interview. The book again is The Three Count, My Life in Stripes as a WWE Referee. Head over to Amazon.com and order a copy, and we hope you enjoyed the program. We'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio. All right, well that's the